This is Art 10, and we've come to a juncture where the fulfilling of our whole direction of inquiry has come to an explosive discovery. We've been at this for a year and a half, and we saw that the whole natural order, the whole ecology of the world in which we discover ourselves has a very strong principle. It has a functioning mode which can be identified. And the English word that we use at the close of the 20th century to talk about the way things work in the natural way, and that word is integration. So that when you come to a very powerful statement by one of the world's greatest composers, Igor Stravinsky, delivering a series of lectures to the students of Harvard University at a time when Europe was sinking into the beginnings of the Second World War, we're not surprised that one of the world's greatest composers on such an auspicious occasion to such a learned audience should make a statement like this. Only the integral man is capable of the effort of higher speculation that must now occupy our attention. It's a wonderfully powerful statement, and it's flawed. Part of our education here is to understand how it can be that such a powerful creative artist, such a great example, who we use as one of our texts, making such a powerful statement that seems to ring so true of everything that we have discussed. How is it, how can it be that one could even say that this is an error, much less a crucial error? The very simple way to begin understanding why it is that this is a crucial error is to understand that there is another process that is at least equally powerful to integration, and that process is differentiation. And we need to keep reminding ourselves, not by a string around our finger, and hopefully not by some noose around our neck, but reminding ourselves by actual usage, that whatever comes together also goes apart. Whatever integrates also differentiates. And that these two processes are related together in such a way that the classic attention to this complementation, integration and differentiation, the classic way in which men and women, in the original reminding of themselves that both have to be taken into consideration, that both count not only equally, but all the time, so that it isn't just equal on an occasion. They're not just equal in terms of an event, but that they occupy an equivalence quality that is so universal that it is the balance of reality. And the classic way in which men and women originally reminded themselves of it was the process of breathing. In order for us to live, we must breathe in, and then we must breathe out. So that the ecology of simply breathing was the reminder in a symbolic way that integration and differentiation go together like the breathing process. And that the whole world breathes, the universe breathes. And because the universe breathes, and the world breathes, and we breathe, and all reality has this breathing aspect, air became the symbolic way in which one would talk about spirit. The Greek word was pneuma, out of which one gets pneumatic, and not just a pneumatic drill by compressed air, but pneumatic originally meant spiritual. It meant that that double functioning, like breathing, was the characteristic form of the way in which reality worked. It had to be that way. It was confirmable. One could investigate. And to settle for a statement that reads like this, only the integral man is capable of the effort of higher speculation. And the rest of the sentence we can add in just a minute. Only the integral man is capable of higher speculation. Try breathing in and not breathing out. That's exactly what happens. If you limit yourself to integration, you eventually get asphyxiated. You get puffed up. There has to be a release, and if you don't do it, then nature, all by herself, will do it for you. If you do not consciously incorporate differentiation with your integration, then the differentiation process happens without your knowing it, without your permission, without your guidance, without your control. But differentiation that is not conscious happens in such a way then that the differentiation becomes, let's say, non-conscious. Let's use that instead of unconscious. Subconscious is all right. It actually works as a term. But let's say non-conscious. It means that the breathing out happens in such a way that it comes out without you knowing about it. And this process in psychology is called projection. That instead of making the conscious distinctions that are necessary for understanding analytically, then they happen in this non-conscious way. And how do they base themselves? If they do not have a conscious objectivity of formation, they have to find that formative objectivity someplace within, someplace in nature. And nature has only two objective focuses. Nature focuses in things, and nature focuses in inner things. Nature focuses in bodies, existent objects, or it focuses in internal, interior objects, interior things, like ideas, like images, like symbols. And so if we are not conscious about breathing out about differentiation, about letting go in its order, integration always has this kind of breathing process. Whatever we bring together has to be allowed to have its resonance out. Otherwise, you get a muffled effect. It's like having a bell which you ring and you muffle it so it cannot vibrate. You cancel out the bell. You get nothing. You imagine that you hear the bell because you would not even hear it. And so projections, non-conscious differentiation, takes the form of projections which are imagined effects. They do not really happen. And when you look to see if this person or this event, or these things have been influenced by your resonances, which you have muffled, you get surprised or angry or downright hostile that they haven't heard you. They haven't done this. This event hasn't changed. The situation is not different. A mind which becomes the arbiter, the internal objectives, which becomes the arbiter because the differential objectivity is not there, the person is not there, not functioning, not allowed to function, muffled. The breathing out form of the objective person is made inoperative. And so the very first place that nature seeks to put it is in the interior objectivity of the symbols, of the images, of the mind. So nature comes to the mind and says, you have to be the objective arbiter. And the mind, because it has a very peculiar relationship to nature, the body has a very direct relationship with nature. The connection is primordially instantaneous. But the mind is removed from nature by several phases, by several steps. In order for the mind to contact nature, it uses the medium of its own structure. And the medium of the structure of the mind is largely through neural impulses that come as sensations, that come as perceptions, that come as images, and tend to form themselves along two very important families of ways. The first family of ways is the closest to the mind. It's the family of ways that are related to language. Language shapes those impulses, gives them forms. Or it comes from rituals, ritual comportment, the habits, the doing which we have done so many times that we just automatically depend upon these ways of doing. And so ritual and language. And language, we have learned, is the mythic level. So ritual and myth come in between nature and symbols, between the mind's objectivity and nature's honest propensity to simply be truthful all the time. In between is ritual and myth, language and existential objectivity, for the actions make the thing. The mind has no way to be immediate with nature unless the ritual and mythic levels can be brought into such an equanimity that they pose no barrier, that they pose no interphase relationship And this is very hard to do. To have the mind direct with nature is a triumph of human experience and human symbol forming, which is very rare, very difficult to master. Yes, the Zen master can do it. But not everyone who says they are Zen master is a Zen master. You yourself, if you are a Zen master, it doesn't occur to you that you are a Zen master. The only actual proof that you are a Zen master if you meet another Zen master. Because what happens when two Zen masters meet is that nothing happens. And that's the proof. There was a time, one of the early young lamas, Chogyam Trungpa, who went to England in the late 50s, driven out of Tibet by the Red Chinese Army, and he learned English, and he showed up in the early 1960s in Berkeley, California. And he was relating his early experience and training. He said, I was discovered when I was about 2 years old to be an incarnation of a lama in a lineage, the Trungpas. And so he was trained. He was given over as a little tiny baby to some very sophisticated lamas to train, and the lama in charge of all of his training was one of the most powerful lamas of that day. His name was Jamgon Kongtrul, who wrote a book called The Torch of Certainty. It's been translated into English. So when Chogyam Trungpa was 9, he was finally taken away from the special tutors and he was put with the root guru, the main tutor. And the main tutor lived up in a little house that had no windows. And the little 9-year-old Chogyam Trungpa would go up there with his little mittens and his furs, and he would go in there and he would sit in the darkness with only light coming through the slats in the boards. And he said that his master would look at him and he would say, "Do you like being here?" And he would say whatever he would say. And they would just sit there, and he would say nothing more. And then his master would say to him, when he was set to leave, "Now don't tell anyone about what happened." And he would walk down from there, and he would puzzle in his 9-year-old mind, "What happened?" And it began to worry him, and by the time he was 10, he was so frustrated that one day he burst out to the master. He said, "I don't know what not to tell." And the master smiled and said, "Good." He said it wasn't until he was about 14 or 15 that it suddenly occurred to him that the whole point was that nothing happened. There's no association whatsoever, that the link is so, the interface is completely clear. There's no rebound. There are no questions. Nothing. It's the same relationship of the little baby to the mother. The little baby smiles, not automatic so much, but in resonance with the mother. Little tiny babies smile. They can't even focus their eyes because they are a resonance which is a part. The baby is a resonance of the mother. When two Zen masters meet, it's like two open doors. They look completely through each other, and that's how they know. Nothing happens. There's nothing to say. I remember meeting Master Ni the first time 76th generation Taoist master from China, who used to go with his father to collect little herbs along the stream beds in China, because they were very poor, because China had been through generations of war, and came over, and now his sons are very successful doctors. And Master Ni said to me, after we sat together for about an hour in his garden, we didn't say anything at all. I was going out his front door, and he stopped me, put his hand on my cheek to feel. He said, "I didn't know Americans came in that variety." It's this quality of differentiation, which is openness. It's allowing reality to breathe. It's allowing the objects to have their resonance of freedom in the universe, so that whatever influences are real can happen. This differential ecology is a complement to integration. Integration makes the world of things. It makes the world of bodies. And it makes the world of minds. For minds are integral. For certain, minds are integral. In fact, they're the ultimate integral form. But there is more to life than the body and the mind. People used to talk, before they were embarrassed about having religious connotations to the word spirit, they used to say, men and women used to say quite openly on a daily basis, that the spirit was just as important as the body and the mind. It used to be a function of education that you develop the character of the students. The character is not their body. It's not what they look like physically. It's not that they are handsome or they're athletic or whatever it is. It is also not their mind. It's not their ability to form symbolically ideas precise and clear and all this. The character is something else. A parent can see the character of their child before that mind is even formed. You can tell from the way in which a child is, even at a month, 2 months old, the kind of character of that child. My daughter was so specific that it came as no surprise to me that when she learned to talk, one of the first favorite words she had was why. And the little compound word was how come. And that was her arsenal, more than mama and daddy, how come. And you would explain and again and again. And you would finally get exhausted and you'd say, well, because of some things. Yes, but which some things? That kind of poignancy is character. It has nothing to do with the body. It has nothing to do with the mind. It has everything to do with the differential form of the character, of the person, of the spirit. And for this stupid age not to recognize that the character is objectively real, that the spirit is the equal to the body and the mind in its objective formation is very grave error. And for a world-class composer to say only the integral man is capable of the effort of higher speculation is an error. It's wrong. But the error shows up subconsciously, non-consciously in Stravinsky, because he doesn't say higher differentiation or higher consciousness, he says higher speculation. So despite himself, he's truthful. And this makes Stravinsky one of the world's great artists. In spite of his strict upbringing, in a Greek Orthodox Russia that he was born in 1882, a Greek Orthodox Russia that was absolutely cemented airtight for 1,000 years by the Byzantine Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox Christianity that it had. Stravinsky was simply born into that such a way that his bones had the impress of it. The bones of his body were formal. The structure of the mind of the man was formal. But the spirit of Stravinsky was something else. And when he practiced his art as a spiritual person, he was able to, we say, transcend. But it wasn't so much transcend as to resonate, to breathe out. And so one hears in Stravinsky's music, despite statements that he might make about it, one hears the quality of openness. One hears the quality of differential resonance, such that most cultivated ears listening to music in the world for the last 80 years, four generations. Since the First World War, almost any discriminating music lover and listener says of Stravinsky that he made a revolution in music. He extended the range of what music could express, and that there are very rare individuals who are able to do this. That when we look at those individuals who are able to do this, we find that they come at very peculiar junctures of human history. One of the first to do this was a man from Italy. His name was Palestrina. And Palestrina was born into a world where medieval music was very standard for 1,000 years. Musical notation was so fixed that at one time they just drew notes as squares. The square notes of medieval music was what Palestrina was born into about 500 years ago. And music was not so much music of instruments, but music of the human voice. That human voices singing together, a choir, which came from ancient times. But Palestrina developed a way in which within the square notes, one could make sections of the sound to work against one another or with one another or syncopate in place of one another. And he extended that form to the choir so that one part of the choir sang here, another part sang here, and an antiphonal quality began to come in, and the artistic form of the motet was developed and born. And then Palestrina, being a very great artist, took it even further, and he developed the whole experience of taking the form of the voices to play back and forth or together in various ways to make a motet, and then to arrange motets in a set. And at one time, he made a set of 21 motets together to make a musical composition about the Song of Songs, to talk about the beauties of divine love that was a gift to man, that men and women could discover an antiphonal harmony between each other that either alone would be very hard-pressed to find, but that together they could discover it mutually, that this mutual discovery, and so the motet in Palestrina's hands became a revelatory music form in its time. People who sang it had the experience, though they couldn't philosophically tell you what it was they understood, they felt it. And they looked at each other with surprise and discovery. They found that they felt related to each other like a family. that the human beings who sang together in motet choirs achieved a kind of camaraderie that families have. A love for each other, a community came out of that. Another great discoverer in music, Johann Sebastian Bach, who took the kind of almost mathematical repetition of musical notes going according to ritual comportment and arrangement, and suddenly made whole sets of these note progressions function as a note in a larger sense of composition. And out of this came the discovery and the whole birth of the Baroque in music, that one could make musical compositions that were so large that one's whole experience of what was possible musically was stretched, and that once one was stretched in this way, you came out and men and women found that they had whole fields of openness, of feeling possibilities that they never had before. That the music stretched them open to such an extent that they were no longer satisfied to leave alone the closed little lives that they were leading. That the ranges of feeling that they used to be able to work with and be satisfied with were now too small. Plus, they were inelastic. And so men and women began to change. They began, after experiencing this musical stretching, to have more space of feeling. And it took a while for someone to finally get the idea that there could be a personal expression of the Baroque. That one could do this not just in some kind of formal way of stretching people in a formal way like Bach, but that one could mean to do this in your way. And old Papa Haydn discovered this. He discovered that you could put a personal signature of your favorite notes in your favorite sequence, in your favorite sets, and that people could begin to feel, not only in a new way, but they could feel how you felt in this new way. And they began to have a comparison. They knew how they felt now, that they were stretched and enlarged and renewed, but they also knew how Papa Haydn, that's why he got his name Papa. And one young kid got it right away that Haydn had struck a gold mine. And young Mozart modeled himself on Haydn, but he wanted to not only have Haydn's learned papa-like personality, but Mozart was a precocious kid who wanted to have a universal personality. I didn't want to just have the personality that I was born with or given, or that society has allowed me to develop. I want to put into my music my personality if it were completely free, if it were joyously free. And when Mozart got through stretching people's feelings, music had a capacity that was astonishing, totally astonishing. And it's not just because Europeans in Vienna are listening to Mozart that they could do this. You can play Mozart in Shanghai and the Chinese can have this stretching feeling and get it also. Their musical personality becomes prodigious, so that one finds compositions by modern Chinese composers have a fantastic capacity at differentiation that was never there in Chinese musical history that goes back 4,000 or 5,000 years. All of a sudden, it's there. It isn't the property of a geographical area. It's the capacity of human beings anywhere. These are gifts of universal application. Stravinsky comes Almost 200 years after Mozart, after fantastic developments, and Stravinsky's ability to stretch human feeling is so sophisticated, so incredibly vast. When he is good, when he is on, one becomes capable of almost indefinite refinement. And yet, when one listens to a Stravinsky piece, the first musical pieces that he brought out, people resented that they had this ability to stretch themselves not only out and up, which was okay in Victorian times. You could go as high as you want, you could go as wide as you want, but they were fearful about the depths, about being stretched down to basics, stretched down to those lower ranges that they would like to have forgotten about. That it reawoke instincts. It reawoke the capacity to get not only into the depths of the mind, but into the depths of the body. And everything that that entailed. Eros and experiences that one had almost forgotten about that were so primordial. And so they threw shoes and cabbages and everything except acclaim at the early Stravinsky. The rite of spring was heard and was called barbaric. Absolutely embarrassing. The word that rang was revolutionary. And so Stravinsky, in the Poetics of Music, the first time in his life he had a chance to speak to a world-class, worldwide audience, he said, "I'm not a revolutionary." Of course he said that. He said, "I am daring, but I am not a revolutionary. I'm founded on principles which have a dogmatic statement." Of course he would say this, because he had shuddered to his bones, and it was his bones that were speaking, but it was Stravinsky's character that was composing the music. And you can see, because there are videotapes now available, of films that were taken of Stravinsky conducting his own work. And when he walks up to the podium, he is the formal old man who comes from the 19th century, Russian Orthodox religious bones. That's right. He's the completely fastidious, elegant man with two-toned shoes and glasses and a severe expression, and everyone must behave. But when Stravinsky conducting gets into the music, into the work, invisible wings come out of the man. He's like some avenging angel of people who weren't able to breathe sufficiently for such a long time, that now they take great, huge breaths. And there's Stravinsky in the music, and he is taking these huge breaths. He himself has composed this music. He himself is conducting this music. And you can see it. You feel it. You feel the man is 80 years old in some films. 85 years old. He has the vitality of a man who's 25. Is the passion of a 15-year-old. That music comes out of him. And if you can let the musical form resonate in your person, in your character, in your spirit, not in your mind, not in your bones, but in the musical resonance of your differential consciousness, one is able to experience in a new way. We saw that in nature, experience always happens in the body and registers in such a way that it flows in a language energy, and by that language interiorizes, penetrates into the mind. So that experience links the body and the mind together. Experience is that interface process, that interface phase that links them together. But the experience in between the body and the mind is transformed because when it links the mind with the person, myth transforms itself into vision. And instead of language being mythic, language becomes magic, magical, becomes conscious. Not only does one feel it, but one knows that you are feeling it. One has the experience and adds the consciousness to the experience while it is happening. And this is called creativity. On the tribal level, the people doing the ritual dance certainly feel the experience, but they don't creatively allow it to breathe. That's left for the divine. God will do the breathing for us, and does. But there's a divine spark in man that he is able to breathe himself. And it's not a displacing of the divine, but it's a participation with the divine. So the artist has this quality of understanding that his conscious experience now is the way in which the divine feels when creation, when the morning stars sing together, is the way Blake used to do it. Used to make this beautiful illustration in the illustration to the books of Job. With all the angels having their arms around each other's shoulders, linked together, because it's a resonance of brotherhood of the celestial choir. Why do the angels in heaven do? They play music. They sing. Why would they play music? Why would they sing? Because they are creative artists who participate in the reality of the differential functioning of the real. The realm of heaven doesn't belong to bodies. It certainly doesn't belong to minds. But it's that higher resonance of the spiritual person getting in tune and touch with the cosmos, the objective allness of the heaven. Does that happen? Yes. Let's take a break. Let's come back to a focus that's familiar to us. When we started this course, we took a technique which was new. Instead of taking a book, instead of taking a single codex, that's the Greek name for this form, which has been the arbiter of the mind for 2,000 years. The first person to use a codex, a book, was a Roman lawyer who won every case. His name was Cicero. Because he needed a quick index. He didn't want to have the scrolls that you have to unroll and read all the way, or unroll it all the way to find something. He wanted a quick crib note index. And he would win his law cases, partly because he was one of the most brilliant men of his time, but also partly because he used the book as a book. The writers of the New Testament never wrote out a scroll. They made a book. And not only was it so profound that the codex, the book form, was made for early Christianity, what became Christianity, but early rabbinic Judaism also. At the Council of Jamnia, it was decided that the form of the Masoretic text of the Torah was going to stay put, and it was put into a book. And when Islam came along, they used the Quran. All those religions are peoples of the book. And for 2,000 years, the book has been the symbolic fulcrum upon which the ideas of the mind of our civilization have been able to find a balance and a base point. The form has changed, but the new form has not yet emerged. And because it hasn't emerged, we have to have an interim technique that still allows us to use books as books, but allows us to peer over the edges and around the sides and underneath. So we pair books. We use a pair of books together. And by pairing books and changing the pair every month, a new pair every month, we're able to navigate in a new way that still has recognizable techniques. The roots still go down 2,000 years. But our exploring, our navigation has resonances the next 2,000 years in the future. Whatever form is going to come out will be recognizable to people who use this method. And the pair of books we're using this month are Schiller and Stravinsky. We're using Stravinsky's The Poetics of Music, and we're using Schiller's On the Aesthetic Education of Man. And not only is this just a pair of books, but this is a pair of books that put in parentheses the whole 19th century. Schiller's book, his Aesthetic Letters, comes at the beginning of the 19th century. Stravinsky comes at the end of the 19th century. And though he gives The Poetics of Music, 1939, he's speaking from a certainty that he already had there as a young man. At the beginning of the 20th century, he had this kind of certainty, he says in his lectures. I had this certainty a generation ago, but this is the first chance I've had to enunciate it. Now, we've taken Stravinsky pretty strongly on one of his statements. Let's take him strongly on another that we can get behind 100%. Because he's a very great man. And he is a formative artist of the 20th century. He belongs there with Matisse and many of the other formative artists, Henry Moore. Here's another little quotation, some food for thought, a base for consideration. He's talking about how music takes place in time, that it's a chronological art. Painting is a spatial art, music is a chronological art, temporal art. And he says that the problem of time is of capital importance. Then he brings up a pair. And notice again, we're pairing books. We're constantly talking about pairs. We're always talking about how there's not just something, but whatever is the something, there's a background, a context that goes with it. And the resonances occur in the context. So there's always pairedness. In the Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu says that when you go to the deepest that you can go about things, pairedness is always there. When you go to the Tao, below pairedness, you can get there, but you can't say much about it. What you can talk about the nameable things at their deepest, they're paired. But what you can't talk about, what is unnameable, nevertheless real, the Tao, it's unpaired. The whole principle of a Platonic dialogue was that the essential archetypal form was a dialogue, two people talking about an issue. And you talked about it in a paired way, pro or con. You maintain something, your dialogue partner will take the other side. And that this process, Plato called it dialectic, that if you take this process assiduously, you will find that this pairingness, this pro and con, registers at only certain levels. It doesn't register everywhere. Only at certain levels will it have a registry where you can have a good argumental point, pro and con. The argumental points will always have a pro and a con. And they will always register at a certain level. And if both are attentive, their conversation will formalize into a dialogue. And these points of pro and con will go deeper and deeper, and you together as a pair will go deeper and deeper. Like an Archimedean screw, like an auger, you will go deeper and deeper, and you will find that the screw bit purchases, gains traction only at certain points. Certain argumentative points. That's why an argument has points. What's the point? Not of the whole argument, but what's the point now at issue? Do you see how the language is really tight? It's really formal. It isn't question and answer. It's a dialogue of a paired use of language that augers down point by point, level by level, until in every Platonic dialogue you find that these points have a limited number of descents. There are a limited number of steps at which they can register. It's like a universal process. If you take the electromagnetic spectrum and you take visible light, light registers all through the tens of thousands of angstroms, but it registers as colors, red, blue, yellow, only at very specific wavelengths. You can specify what the wavelength of red is, what blue is, what yellow is, down to the hundredths of the thousandths of an angstrom. That's a pretty small vibration. You can get what green is, what orange is, what violet is. Exactly. You can number the rainbow. Scientifically. When one talks about quantum jumps, what's a quantum jump? It means that in the electromagnetic spectrum, energy, electromagnetic energy, registers at certain levels, and there are some points, some levels, at which energy does not register. It goes up to here, and then it jumps, and it registers next here, and in between there's a jump. That's what a quantum jump is. It's like in your neuronal networks, the cells of your nerves in your brain. The roots, the axons of one cell don't quite touch the roots of another cell. The dendrites and the axons don't quite touch. And the impulse of electromagnetic energy has to jump. It's called the synapse gap. It's like a quantum jump. It's like there is a point in a Platonic dialogue where the point doesn't register. There's no clear pro and con. But all of a sudden, at this point, there is a clear pro and con. And at this point, at this point, at this point, and that those points have a spectrum. And when it runs out exactly at a threshold where you understand, where the two philosophically understand that they have come to a point where there's no more dichotomy. There's no more pro and con. That this last point is a point of harmony. That you have worked your way to agreement. You've come to understand mutually that you both now understand that this is what obtains. Neither pro nor con. Aletheia, truth. That truth is an objective arrival point, which you can work at by a paired process. We're using paired books in this way. But like Plato, 2,500 years ago, used the pro and con, we live in a time of vast civilization ready to go to the stars. We have to use the building blocks of the civilization and of the mind as our paired points. And we have to establish many. Not just the 7 points of a Platonic descent to truth. We use a series of pairs of books, always in sets of three, 3 pairs, and then we'll have a single text, the pair of which in the 4th level will come at the end of the next set. So that the sets are not aligned so much as linked. So that every 12 weeks we've made a link, and the 13th week is the beginning of a link that will have its complement, will have its pair in the 26th week. And we discovered that there's a universal form, at least on this planet, follows the seasons. That the seasonal cycle, the 4 seasons, the 4 quarters, the 4 angles of a square, that the square of attention, the frame of reference, that this is a primordial thing on our planet. That men and women in every variety have found veracity in using this kind of geometry of event. That it holds, you can build on it, you can trust it. I don't know if you ever saw the first film of Conan the Conqueror, John Milius, and some other very famous filmmakers, Oliver Stone. They all worked together to make a great film. And at the very beginning, the young Conan as a boy is being shown what's real by the old experienced warrior. He's saying, when it gets tough, you can't count on other men and other women on the past. And then he holds up the sword. He says, in this you can trust steel. And that steel is a mystery. The metal is a gift from God, but the way to make the metal into a sword is the mysterious wisdom of man working with God. And then he slaps his hand and he says, in this you can trust. It'll always be there for you. Anytime you need it. That's why you have to learn to use it. This is an education that's giving you not only steel for the 21st century, but for the next couple of millennia. In these forms you can trust because they will work. They'll be there for you. You can grow with them. You can fight with them if you need to. But you can love with them. You can build families with them. You can build a civilization with them. And they'll always be there. Now, this pair of books that we have, this time, Stravinsky in his Poetics of Music and Schiller in his Aesthetic Letters, Schiller and Stravinsky. This is the kind of person we're talking about. This is Schiller from A Life Mass. You can see the quality of integrity. And I'll bring a Xerox, can tell my age. I'll bring a copy of a portrait of Stravinsky next week. Here's Stravinsky. He's talking about how music, which is a time, we're coming back now. See, we're going on a big excursion, we're coming back. Stravinsky is going to make a very powerful point here in a paired statement. He's talking about how music is a temporal art, and then he comes out with a bombshell. Something that you can count on, you can trust. It's coming from the creative genius of the artist. Because he has confidence in the formulaic basis of his bones, he can now, in his differential person, open his wings and say something which is completely resonance, is with the entire cosmos. Music that is based on ontological time is generally dominated by the principle of similarity. The music that adheres to psychological time likes to proceed by contrast. Wow. You can engrave that on the spaceships. You can put it with little molecular drills on every atom of the steel or titanium or whatever it's going to be of the spaceships. You can put it as a signature there. Ontological has to do with being. It has to do with the ultimate root of what is real. Psychological has to do with the mind. Ontological has to do with the person, has to do with the spirit. An ontological form is the spiritual person. The artist is an ontological form, actually exists, objectively real, quite real. An artist is as real in their spiritual person as any rock. When Antoine Lavoisier was first writing the elements, the traits of elementary chemistry, he made sure that his readers understood that when he was talking about the reality of material, that it had a weighable calibration, a specific gravity. And at the back of Lavoisier's great textbook on chemistry about the time of the French Revolution, he pointed out some very peculiar qualities. That gold that comes from the earth has a specific gravity about 2.5 times that of cast iron. So we're about 19.3. But that hammered gold, when it's made into rings, like a wedding ring, hammered gold has a higher specific density. Not by much. It's like 19.5 instead of 19.3. Any metal that's worked, that's hammered, that's ball-peened, gains in specific gravity. A mechanical action is enough to densify material world. What more powerful densification is there in processes that are much more powerful than the mechanical? The spiritual process is so much more effective than the mechanical that it goes off a graph. One can't even find it. And so there'll be a 21st century chemistry where there'll be the specific gravity of someone who in a conscious way hammered that gold. And it'll be a noticeable difference. Because what we do is real. And what we do consciously gains a resonance which records, and it records everywhere. You know that plants grow better for certain people than others. It's that kind of a principle. Music, now we're coming back again. Always doing these sachets. The old hermetic hunting wisdom is that when you're lost, when you don't know where you are, you start from wherever you are, and you make a sachet one way and come back. Then you make a sachet the other way and come back. And you keep enlarging these sachets in an alternating way, and you will build a map of acquaintance of the situation, of the territory, of yourself, by starting wherever it is that you are, and by keeping the methodological balance, by keeping an equanimity, a paired application, you will build up, just like a scanning, you will build up an accurate topography on any level, on any dimension necessary, even in terms of a complex field which is like a sphere of conscious time-space. You can build up a topographical acquaintance with the entire cosmos that way, which could be trusted, because you can repeat it scientifically. Not only from where you are starting this way, but anybody that you choose, you can educate them to start from wherever they are and build up this topography, this ontological sense. Ontological time, music that is based on ontological time, is generally dominated by the principle of similarity, that is, the paired resonance. It's not identity. Identity only holds on the level of the ritual, the mythic, and the symbolic. Identity only holds in the integral cycle. In the differential phase of reality, identity does not hold at all. It shouldn't hold. Why should it hold? It's a principle in the integral mode. It's irrelevant in the differential. But similarity holds in the differential. Resonances, correspondences. If you throw a pebble in the pool, the ripples are going to go everywhere. And if there are no obstructions, this ripple, 5 feet away from where the pebble went in, will be exactly the same height as this ripple, 5 feet in the other direction. And the entire rim of that ripple will be similar. Any two points will have a similarity. You can count on it. It's like a physics. You can write out the differential calculus equations of it. And they not only prove out and make sense, but they apply. So that when you're talking about identity, if you're on the integral functioning, you can talk about identity holding. But if you're a spiritual person searching for an identity, you're not going to find it in openness, are you? You're not going to find it in conscious time-space unless you inhabit that in a differential way. Where will you find your identity? Back in the mind or back in the body? The only two objective places where it can register. It temporarily seems to register in language so that people talk a good game about identity. But when you squeeze it to proof, it has to obtain in the body or in the mind. Now, most people are not trained enough to keep objectivity in the mind for very long. They get pretty tired, downright sloppy. And so it goes to the body, usually. And it registers in the body. And the body registers it not as the mind, but as the body. And so the flesh, the bones, have to take the bludgeoning impact, because usually this identity inculcation is not coming from nature. The body can take what comes from nature and it distributes it naturally. But when the body receives what comes in regressive form, like the search for an identity, it impacts and bruises, causes tumors, does all sorts of things. Because the body's trying to catch something which has been thrown at it, rather than to process nature which has come to it. What did Indiana Jones say in one of the films? She said, you're awful bruised up for such a young man. He said, it's not the years, it's the mileage. We have this beautiful opportunity. It used to be said in Asia about 2,300 years ago, the time of Ashoka in India. One of the favorite sayings of that time was, out of all the incalculable aeons that you have gone through different forms, you're now at a threshold where you could have a realization. Why would you throw it away now that you have worked so long to get here where you could now have it? But you have to recognize the opportunity. Yeah, there's lots of other things to do. There always will be. There always is. But you have to be savvy enough to know that this is the place, this is the time, and you can do it. And once that threshold is crossed, it's done. It's like having learned to ride a bicycle. You forever have that balance of freedom. Anytime, anybody brings you a bicycle, you could get on and ride. That spiritual personal freedom is something that takes a crossing of a threshold, a crossing from a threshold where psychological integration is the arbiter, to a dimension where ontological differentiation is now the functioning principle. Do you get it? It's that quality where one needs to make a change of threshold. And it's a universal quality. If you were able to be 2 light years away from our star, and you had super eyes like a powerful eagle, and you could see all the planets and all the satellites, all the asteroids, they circle our star with about the width of this paper. The whole star system is on a plane that's paper thin in vast interstellar space. But this plane of the star system, though nobody draws a sheet of paper, no one draws a line in stellar space, yet whenever a planet or an asteroid or a moon crosses the threshold of this plane of the star system, there is a noticeable shift in frequency of that body. The bow shock of that body in terms of the solar wind modifies slightly. The Earth experiences that every time there's an equinox, every spring and every autumn. At the vernal equinox, the Earth goes above the plane of the star system, and at the autumnal equinox, it goes below the plane of the star system. Easter and Halloween as a universal phenomenon. You don't have to be religious. Not if you don't want to. If it bothers you, that's all right. But you do have to have an awesome appreciation for the incredible accuracy of the real. That even something like a planet registers and tips its hat to what's going on. There are planes that include thousands of star systems. And when those star systems got up above or below those planes, the whole families of star systems register that that happened. This is a quality which Stravinsky is not only integrating here, but he's differentiating here. He's saying something powerful about music. Music is an art that happens in time, but time is paired. There's a psychological time, there's an ontological time. In psychological time, music seems to proceed, he says, likes to proceed by contrast, like a syncopation, like an alternation, like an antiphonal quality. But Music also has equally, equivalently, in equilibrium, an ontological capacity for similarity. There are resonances. Now you can hear it graphically when you play for yourself musical examples of someone who's characteristically always in ontological time, or music which is characteristically always in psychological time. And you can hear it. If you will play for yourself a Baroque piece of music, let's say something by one of the Scarlattis, and immediately, or Vivaldi or Corelli, immediately play after that a composition, let's say, by somebody like Alan Hovhaannis, one hears that there's a whole different quality to the music. Both are appreciable. Both are music. Both are capable of an artistic experience, but each of these examples has quite a distinct quality to it. The Hovhaannis is all built on similarities, on resonances that remind one of an Indonesian gamelan orchestra, where the overlapping of the resonances of the gamelans in the orchestra make this vibrant pattern of shimmering mobility that has no outer edges, has only openness. It's a music which is characteristic of the way in which drama is archetypally presented in Indonesia, let's say in Java or in Bali. The Wayang has his cutout puppets. For sure, they're just cutout puppets. They're cardboard figures. And in front, he'll have a screen, a sheet, some kind of white translucence, and a torch or a kerosene lamp, something, a light source behind. And you sit in front and you watch the shadows, the shadow play of the puppets on the screen. But you are also free to walk around and come back where the gamelan orchestra is. You can come back there if you want. You can sit back there and you can watch the Wayang move the puppets and not look at the shadows, but look at the puppets or look at the Wayang. You can fall asleep if you want. It goes on all night. Might as well catch a few naps. You can wake up, you can walk around, you can talk, you can be quiet, you can eat if you want or not. In the morning, after a night of the similarity of the correspondence of the ontological shimmering web of the gamelan and the Wayang, you come away from that performance. It isn't so much that you heard something, it's that your bones have been massaged. You come away with a lightness. It's like scuffing clouds with your feet. You've been put into a state where gravity no longer is quite as effective as it used to be. You've learned that you have a buoyancy of the spirit, which the earth, which the mechanical realm, doesn't quite weigh down anymore. And you get it, that enough inoculations of this and you're going to be free to fly. You're going to be given spiritual wings. And then you come back and you listen to something like a cassette. I've heard three different places in the last week, an old cassette from the 50s, an old record from the 50s, now put on a CD. Miles Davis. It's called Kind of Blue. Miles Davis and Milt Jackson and John Coltrane and the group. And you listen to the way in which Milt Jackson does those xylophones, those vibratories, those vibes. And the way in which Miles Davis weaves his melodic line into the spherical similarity, vibrations and resonances of what is being laid down there, the way in which Coltrane chases and follows and does a kind of a dance, a syncopation with that. And you come away and you realize that there are some times when American jazz is like a Wei Yang performance. You've been carried away into ontological time for a while, and you get it that this old square way of needing to do it this way because it's identity and principle, that that's fine, but that also you can fly. Now all of a sudden you notice not only do you look around and you see that a lot of Indonesian decorations are flying angelic beings, beautiful angels carved out of wood and brightly colored, and they're just suspended everywhere, and you get that way too. One of the big sayings in ancient China about the I Ching was that the I Ching suspends its symbols. That when you're in the Tao, symbols are suspended. They're no longer gravity glued to some identity base, but they're free to be real. Not only ambidextrously, but 360 degrees through all dimensions. This is a quality of freedom. This is what human beings talk about when they say freedom. This American rock group from time called the Chambers Brothers. They did a wonderful long rock piece called Time, and it went on forever, and people bought the album because it's the only way you could get the song. It went on forever. But on that album, there was also a little cut, a little song that Lester Chambers liked especially. It was called People Get Ready. People get ready, there's a train a-coming. You don't need no ticket. You just climb on board. It's a train to the promised land. You don't need a ticket. No one's taking tickets. But the train is there. And all you have to do is to know that this is the time to get on board. And you can go. You don't have to worry about your identity. You have to participate in the similarity that's everywhere. This is an ontological quality. Stravinsky is very alert to this. He could compose either way, both ways, and you can hear it in his music. When he takes a composition, like The Rite of Spring, he starts off in a psychological time, a time tempo, which is so emphatic, almost violent, as to show the stamping of primitive feet on the packed earth when men and women put on animal skins to invoke animal powers in the spring. That same Stravinsky turns that same music into a ballet. The Rite of Spring was not on a dirt floor with savage human beings in animal skins trying to get animal powers, but it was a ballet staged and choreographed in France, the Ballet Russe. This was an artistic performance of great agility, and one can still see it. One could go and see a presentation of this ballet. One could see photographs of the way in which the beautiful sets made by Nicholas Roerich, who was a Tibetan aficionado and a mystic. One could see the great way in which the dancers like Nijinsky trained themselves to do fantastic new pirouettes, because the old classical ballet never required those kinds of movements. And for the first time, you might have a pirouette that's a double pirouette in midair. And you have to be really in tremendous shape to do that. For a man to hurdle 170 plus pounds twice in rotation and come down without missing a beat on one leg and continue the gracefulness, it takes a lot to do. If you haven't tried it lately, you might try it. It's true that Stravinsky admired Tchaikovsky. He admired the Tchaikovsky ballets. He had the example before him of the late Tchaikovsky, the Swan Lake, where the last movement of Swan Lake is such a gorgeous symphony of inspiring, romantic music that you get swept away. And when you see that ballet really performed and really staged, you're carried away by the depth and scope, the oceanic joy of a classical ballet. And when you go from that to a Stravinsky Rite of Spring, it's like somebody has torn it, but they haven't torn it. It's crossed the threshold. It's on the other side of the plane. It's gone into an ontological time. It's not in psychological time of oceanic joy and happiness. It's in an ontological resonance of an incredible primordialness that's still there and recoverable from a very advanced consciousness. That the very advanced consciousness is a resonance of the very primordial origins. And what Stravinsky in his early ballets was doing was to show what an enormous scope human beings have been able to achieve because the music has stretched them so far that the resonances, the similarities of being, spiritual being music, were enormous by even of the time of 1912, 1914. And we've come a long way since. Music at the late 20th century stretches our musical capacity ontologically as far out as astronomers are able to see 20 billion light years. Human feeling is capable of such refinement now and such nuance, it'll easily take a couple of thousand years just to explore what's there already. Much less the realization that it's wide open, it can go as far as you need to go or want to go. There are no blinders on. There's no limitation. But there is the need for a navigational savvy that just as you can dance barefoot on the good earth with an animal skin, you can see that same rhythm and the exhaust of a spaceship that's going up beyond the gravity of the earth. The flames beat that same rhythm and go, and we can go with it. It's this kind of equality. Here's a quotation from Schiller. This is from his first letter. He's writing to his friend, personal. You see, the letters are like the dialogue form of Plato, one to one. He's going to take it point by point, but there are a lot of points now, because Schiller lives in a time, even 200 years ago, where the refinement was incredible. He begins, he says, "I have, then, your gracious permission to submit the results of my inquiry concerning art and beauty in the form of a series of letters. Sensible as I am of the gravity of such an undertaking, I am also alive to its attraction and worth." And then he says this about two-thirds of the way through the letter, and we'll close with this, and we'll come back next week and catch it again. He's saying in this first letter that the philosophy that's all the rage at this time, late 1790s in Europe, is Immanuel Kant. Kant, especially not just in the critical philosophy, the three great critiques, the critique of pure reason, the critique of practical reason, the critique of judgment, But the pre-critical writings of Kant, the number one publication was a book called Observations on the Feeling of the Beautiful and the Sublime. Beauty, the sublime, a pair. Beauty, something which man's spirit can focus on. The sublime that only God focuses. And that these two focuses have a resonant similarity. They get each other without anything in between. It's an interface of no dimension. Two Zen masters, like two open doors, seeing each other. That when a human being comes to the focus of elated universal beauty, he sees his creator in the sublime majesty of that reality, with no one in between. Scheller says, but it is precisely this technical form, it's a technical form, techne, what can make this happen? It is precisely this technical form whereby truth is made manifest to the intellect, which intellect veils it from feeling. For alas, intellect must first destroy the object of inner sense if it would make it its own. That the mind, in its psychological integral objectivity, can receive the spiritual objectivity from the person who's experiencing beauty. But in order to make that connection, the mind has to let go of its objectivity with the body. And when it lets go of its objectivity with the body, like a child, suddenly orphaned, gets panicked and scared. And it cries out, oh my God, am I left alone? What's happened? There's a very big problem in art, in civilization, in human nature. And we have to look at it again next week.